I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has been called the most famous math teacher in America. Dan Meyer is with us. There was an article about him in the New Republic recently, the man who will save math. He wants to radically change the way we learn mathematics. He's amassed more than 40,000 Twitter followers. His TED Talk has been viewed more than 2 million times. And he has taught high school math to students for a number of years. Many of those students didn't like math very much. He's also advocated for better math instruction on a number of prominent media outlets. He is currently the chief academic officer at Desmos, where he explores and develops the future of math textbooks. He lives in California. He is our guest this hour. How did you learn math? I got to tell you, I never learned much math, and I'm not really very proud of it, but I think that I need to hear what he has to say this hour. And was there a better way for people like me to have learned math? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter, and that is at K Dunn Show. Dan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a treat to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. So when did you really discover math? When did math become, because you're obviously devoting your life to it, something you said, ooh, this is for me. I love this.
You know, I had a series of really powerful experiences using math in my own life. And it's like learning, like I have a special power tool in my toolbox that that I learned how to use. And it's so powerful, I wanted to teach other people how to use that. One of them was cracking the code of the grocery express lines.
Yeah, I love that one. Right. Which line do you go in? How do you figure that out?
The fact that math could help clarify what is a tangible, you know, powerful question for so many people was just electric for me. And that was one of them. And then also in college, I used math, my understanding of math at the time, to help set a Guinness World Record that still stands. A silly record. I'm not proud of it, but I am proud of the thinking and the math that helped achieve it. So I had these powerful experiences, and then I was, at the same time, I was going into math teaching, and I just realized the math I was being asked to taught and how I was being asked to teach it did not testify to those powerful experiences that I had had. And so since then, I've been trying to bridge the gap between the two.
All right, you got to tell us about the Guinness, because it's paperclips, and it's a great story.
So it's a silly story.
It's all right.
But anyway, this is college, so I preface that. It was college, or we're all crazy. But I spent 24 hours, and I chained paper clips for 24 straight hours, making the longest paperclip chain the world has ever seen since or after. The record still stands. I told you it was silly. But the thing was you know, if you don't know mathematics and you do that, you're basically flying blind and hoping that at the end of 24 hours, when you unravel the thing, that you cleared the previous record.
Right.
But knowing some math, what you can do is have some friends. You build a spreadsheet and you call over to a friend and you say, I just finished a box of paper clips. And your friend types in some very basic info, the current time of day and how many clips that was. And then your spreadsheet chews through those numbers that you set up. You create this spreadsheet and it chews through the numbers and gives you projections based on that tell you how long it will be if you keep that current pace. Is your current pace slower or faster than your previous pace? And so on. And all of that was mathematics. And I love that. And I'm so happy to be in a position now that I can help teach and testify to what I love about math.
Yeah. And you write about, you taught high school math for a long time, that probably a lot of students just tune out to math because it's really taught in this very dull fashion, and you kind of turn this whole field upside down, that you really do start with a problem, and that you and people around you, the students, can help figure out what the solution is. It's not in the textbook, page 538, and then go to page 738 for the ultimate answer.
So this is tricky here, and I gotta step lightly. Some of your listeners right now are driving or listening, and they're trying to figure out what side I am on in some particular debate about math education. And others of your listeners are surprised that there is even a debate, or mm-hmm. there's passion in that debate about math education, and there is. And so I have to be careful as soon as I say, like, problem-based learning, I instantly signal something to an entire crowd of people. So I want to be careful there, because there's ways we can bridge this gap. But what I do is not so much just start with a problem and say, hey, kids, figure this out, and congratulate myself for having taught better. What I want to ask myself is, for every new thing that I taught in the classroom when I was a classroom teacher, and now that I help teachers, is why did we invent this? Why did some mathematician thousands of years ago invent this new skill, assuming that it wasn't to torture kids thousands of years later? That's how it often feels, as if this is the next arbitrary thing I have to learn because it is on my teacher's, you know, pacing guide for the year. And a lot of the stuff that we learned that we teach students, we developed it, for instance, out of a need for efficiency. Like the new math that we learn, this new formula or skill or concept, makes the old stuff more efficient. And so what I want to do is put kids in a place to feel inefficiency. Before I offer them a shortcut that we learn now, I want to offer them the experience of the long cut, so it feels purposeful, not just like some new arbitrary thing I have to learn.
When you say that you saw stories beginning, middle, end in everything you taught, I don't think most people think of math as stories, do they? And how did you see stories in a grocery line or other areas?
I totally agree. Right. I agree. It doesn't seem like it lends itself all that well to stories or literacy at all, for that matter. But what I'm saying is I see that we have skill A, and skill A is the hero of our story. And then what happens is that over time, skill A encounters an obstacle or a limit. Like, here's a concrete example. May I? I'm going to give you three numbers, and I want to know what the fourth number is from you. Okay, ready? I already heard your disclaimer that you're not.
I'm really not.
Math. You've got this here. You got this here. All right, here we go. Ready for it?
Okay.
Get some paper and pencil if you need to. 5, 9, 13. What's the next number I'm going to ask you for?
5, 7, 8, 9, 5, 9, 10.
Give her a moment, folks.
17.
17, exactly.
Oh, okay, my gosh, I got it right.
Strong work, Kathleen, strong work. Give us one more just for fun, one more number here.
Oh.
One more in the
21, 17, 18.
Nailed it. You're on a roll. I'm convinced that we could do this for an hour, but here's what I would want to say is, if I were to ask you what the 100th number in that sequence is,
yeah,
like we've taken something that you're strong at, you get this like one by one, it's called recursive formula, and if I want to teach you how to create a different formula, one that will take any number I give you, 100 or 1,000, and give that number in the sequence, I have two options here. One is that I could just teach it to you, teach you how to do that thing, before you know why you need it, before you felt this sense like, I have no idea how I'd find a 100th number, you might be thinking right now. Or I can put you, my kind host, in this moment of doubt, of difficulty. So now you get that, like, oh, I need a stronger tool. And that's the story. That's the conflict, the obstacle that our hero encounters in the first act. And in the second act, I help you overcome that. In the third act, you're able to give me that 100th term. That's the conclusion. So that's where I see the stories in mathematics.
Mm-hmm. What is the role, because we're in this age where people are using computers and they're figuring out stuff with calculators, what is the role of technology in making us more excited about math and in using technology in math study?
Right. That's a huge topic there, one which I spent 5 years of a dissertation on. So being brief, of course, I'm looking recently this January, the Federal Reserve published this chart that goes back 20 years. It shows different jobs as a share of the total economy, and it breaks them down based on physical jobs and mental jobs, routine jobs and non-routine jobs. And I'm looking at this chart and just seeing the effect of technology on the jobs that are available to our students who are graduating. And it just seems so clear from this chart that the jobs that are stagnant are the ones that are routine, both cognitively and manually. The construction jobs, manufacturing jobs, these have faded, whereas non-routine jobs continue to climb in necessity. That's because technology has made what is routine easier for machines and computers to do. And so that has to change the kind of math, and every subject, really, the kind of math that we ask students to perform. Whereas we used to ask students to put numbers into formulas and get values out for those formulas, did a lot of that. Now that emphasis needs to shift. not to zero of doing that, but we need to shift emphasis to creating those formulas. The non-routine workers will say, here's the situation, the grocery line. Now, what is the math in the grocery line scenario? What are the variables that are important? What things might matter for how long it takes you to get out of the grocery line? And now come up with a formula that describes that, not just evaluating that formula for 60 groceries, 40 groceries, mm-hmm. get a number, but coming up with the formula. That's the tricky work nowadays.
Mm-hmm. And what about the role of a teacher? There are a lot of, there are even some school programs now where you do your math behind a computer and you're by yourself. There is a limitation, I've heard you say, on what kind of work can be done on a computer without a teacher. You'll never see, you need a good teacher.
It's true. The promise of technology in a classroom is often that we can make the teacher more efficient by having the students learning from a video on the screen that's talking to them instead of the teacher. The students are assessed by the machine. But what happens is it's so hard to do a lot of really interesting math on the machine right now, or at least the machine doesn't know what you're talking about. So, for instance, like diagrams are impossible. They're so difficult to put into a machine, into the computer, so we don't ask students to do those. So the kind of interesting math we do on computers has shrunken down to very little. And then in terms of assessment, like the computer struggles mightily to figure out what is going on in the student's head, even in ways that are obvious to a human teacher standing next to them. The computer has some very blunt ways of saying, like, oh, you didn't get this. Let me show you a worked out example of a similar problem. But the computer really struggles to figure out what in that problem you just tried to do the student was thinking. So there's still a huge need for teachers who understand student thinking and how to respond to it.
Mm-hmm. In your classroom, and you were in classrooms where students were really disinterested and disengaged, what did you do as a teacher to see what you call a free-form argument of the sort that students do in our best live classrooms? You can have a free-form argument in math?
Yeah, similar to the story metaphor, the thought of argument in math classes sounds foreign to a lot of listeners,
yes.
I'm sure. But the fact is the Common Core state standards adopted in a lot of states nationwide have as one of their 8 foundational practices through all of K-12 is constructing viable arguments, they call them, and also critiquing other people's arguments. So in math class, from K on up, we're talking about having students come up with arguments. Like, for instance, you and your listeners might know that if you add up 2 even numbers, you get an even number. If you add up 2 odd numbers, you also get an even number. But why? Asking the question, why is that? And what students will argue is at first very rough and informal. Like, for instance, well, I did it a bunch of times. I added up a bunch of pairs of odd numbers, and I got even numbers. Therefore, it works. And the job of the teacher and the job of other students is to push back on that and say, well, how do you know? Like, how do you know that the 16th pair you try out will still work? Is there some general principle at work here? And help students formalize and make sharper those arguments, as opposed to just writing them down a fact in your notes that every odd number pair sums up to an even number.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is when you see this story, you, of course, have achieved fame partially because your ideas are really innovative and you've had students respond to you. But you also take problems that are a part of our everyday lives. I reference again the grocery store line, but you've probably done many of these that we all think about every time we go to the grocery store. We look at the lines and say, which one should I choose? And probably, you know, 8 out of 10 times we're wrong about this, and we could use some mathematical problem solving. And it landed you on television too, didn't it? Because everybody thought, wow, this is a good idea, Dan.
Right. Yeah. One of my best moments or worst moments, depending on how you see it. But Good Morning America had me hop into, put the ideas to the test, if you will. So I have this theory about how grocery lines work, and then they have me pick a line in a grocery store that we asked to let us film there, and everyone's staring, and it's weird. And they get into a different line, and we watch to see who's going to win, and I lost. And on the one hand, that's deeply shameful. My family wouldn't talk to me for a week. But on the other hand, this is a testament to how math actually works in the world. In your textbook, you plug a number in into the model and you crunch some numbers. You get an answer out, and it's in the back of the book. Correct. Good on you. It worked out exactly. The math in the world talk perfectly. That's a fake message about how math and the world interact. Really, like, all of our models are broken. The famous mathematician George Bock said, they're all broken, but some are useful. So they're always going to give some noise, some bad answers, but the question is, how often are they correct? And so I walked away feeling like this is a testament to math's true accurate power in the world, but different people can believe different things about that, of course.
Mm-hmm. You also, when you are trying to solve problems, use a lot of different things. You use, there was one, I think it was a TED, no, it wasn't a TED talk, but it was somewhere you were online. How long does it take to fill a water tank? So you're using math reasoning and patient, as you say, problem solving. But you use multimedia, you use a picture of the tank, you use charts that have different colors on them and different images in them, a whole different way of looking at a problem using many more of our senses.
This, to me, is the thrill of being a teacher in this age, is that we have these tools in our pockets for capturing the world around us in high resolution. I mean, the phone that I use to call grandma, you know, takes high-quality video. And so whenever I'm out there in the world and I experience a question, like I'm filling up this enormous tank and wondering how long will this take, or I'm in line at the grocery store wondering how long will this take, or whatever else, I can pull my phone out and capture that. And in a minute or less, it clarifies the point of an investigation to students. I can show them that video and say, here's where I'm at. We can gather info from that video and actually analyze that situation. And that's what's not possible in print-based textbooks of the sort that we've been learning from and teaching from for many, many decades.
Yeah, you could also, while you're in line, call grandma.
It's true. Yeah. While taking a video, it's amazing. What a world
this is. We're going to welcome phone calls for you. And let me give everybody the number so you can join us when you'd like. We're speaking with a man who's been called the most famous math teacher in America. Dan Meyer is with us, and he has taught high school math for a number of years. He has a TED Talk, which is worth your attention. He is right now developing the future math textbooks that we'll be using. His PhD is from Stanford University in math education, and he is the chief academic officer at Desmos, where he explores and develops the future of math textbooks. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. Let's reflect on our math experiences. Mine weren't all that positive, but for some people, I'm sure you're in classrooms that are terrifically exciting, and some of you have found them not as exciting. Let's discuss how important it may be to be able to solve problems in our, which we encounter all day, every day, that require some knowledge of problem-solving skills and patience. We'll talk about word problems. I used to hate those word problems. Maybe some of you find them really intriguing. We have a whole new way of looking at word problems, which we'll hear from Dan as we carry along. All right. To your phone calls momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right. Let's go to phone calls for the most famous math teacher in America. Felicia, we start with you in Sun Prairie. Hi.
Hi. I homeschool my children until this year, and I was wondering, I've been noticing how much genetics seems to play a role. I have 2 6-year-old girls, and they naturally just immediately understood multiplication and so on just by themselves. I also have a 10-year-old boy who is about 2 or 3 years behind in math, but he reads at a college level and everything else. He's normal. So my question for the guest was, does he know if waiting 2 or 3 years just for the math is good? And then my other question was, has he heard about Montessori math and what he thought about it?
Thanks for those questions. Yeah, as far as I know, there's been no math gene discovered, though people do, they are ready for the jump from concrete math to abstract math at different times, certainly. So in these situations, like, because you homeschool and you have such a low teacher-to-student ratio, you know your students so well, you have the ability to target the math that your sons and daughters learn when they need it. So being thoughtful there is certainly important. The Montessori model, I've heard success stories from a lot of people who swear by it and love it. What I know of it is that it involves a lot of student play and free work, and that can go either way as far as I've seen in public school classrooms where students can be very off track and not learn much if the teacher's guidance is very light. So it could probably depend on the exact Montessori school that you were looking at. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Felicia. Matt in Southern California. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Meyer. You've mentioned it a couple times, the future of math textbooks. I'd like to hear more about that and what you think it looks like.
Yeah, great. Thanks for the question, Matt. Nice to hear from you. It's what I love is the idea that students can tinker mathematically and get fast feedback on their tinkering, that they can be exposed to each other's ideas faster and easier and capture all those. So what I'm looking at is basically, what do students love about the internet, and how can we work that into our math textbooks that also live on the internet? As far as I know, students love on the internet the ability to connect with other students through all kinds of social networks, and students love that they can create things on the internet, multimedia, whatever, and share it. Those are things I see them love on the internet. Now, they also love things like Justin Bieber on the internet or whatever else kids love that might have no lessons for us as far as how we design math textbooks. But I think this creation and sharing of creations is huge online, and it can also be huge and should be huge in our math classes, our math textbooks. Our textbook should facilitate students creating arguments, creating graphs, creating pictures, creating equations, whatever, and sharing those nimbly and quickly with each other. That'll be a huge part of whatever it is I help design here at Desmos. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. What's the role of intuition in math?
Look, pick a math concept of any sort, and it can be understood at a very informal level or a very formal level. Like the informal stuff that we did a little while ago, where you found the next number in a sequence, that's informal, and formal is way out there with variables to describe that sequence of numbers. And oftentimes what we do in math class is we jump straight to the most formal version of a concept as possible. So I start by teaching you how to turn this set of numbers into variables without asking you first to access that informal understanding that you clearly had about this. And so I'm thinking also about prediction, the role of prediction. If I ask a student to predict how long it will take me to get through a grocery line or to fill up a water tank, they are that much more interested in knowing the answer later at the end of this. So it ties into student interest also.
Mm-hmm. I also want to talk about word problems. You have, in your TED Talk, I think, talked about redefinition of what a word problem is. There are many of us who dreaded those word math problems. Just, it reached a point where you'd read them and you couldn't even think because you'd get so nervous about what the problem was and how it was worded that you were incapable of getting an answer to it. It was horrible.
Yeah, I hear that a lot from students, from ex-math students such as yourself. And one solution I hear from a lot of math teachers is this. It's that students just don't like to read, they tell me. And it sounds right at first, like students are in a multimedia generation. And so, like, that's the problem. It's this, kids just don't like to read, and we got to just, like, ask them to read it. Like, you do stuff you don't want to do sometimes. But here's the thing that I realized is that students love to read, that young adult fiction is a huge booming business, that there are these young adult series that kids read nonstop and have made zillions of dollars. The problem isn't that kids don't like to read. The problem is that what we ask them to read is the most boring, tedious text imaginable. If you can imagine a favorite, you know, young adult fiction, Hunger Games or whatever, reformulated as a math textbook word problem, it would be a very boring story indeed. It would tell you everything about the characters from the jump. It would tell you all their motivations, their backstories, and it would pose some question, the central question of the story, at the very end of the book. Like, will they survive the Hunger Games, let's say? It would be posed at the very end. Basically, word problems are just a strange genre that math teachers invented. So how to fix that is to, number one, make sure students know the point of word problems at their start and not at their very end as we currently have it. And then rather than giving students all that information right away, there's like three or four sentences that tell you this and that, like, just ask students, like, what information do you think would be helpful to help have us solve this with no information there yet? So you can offer that after they've debated and discussed. Like, for instance, I'll ask you, Kathleen, like, if you want to get through a grocery line as fast as possible, I could give you a word problem that told you this fact and that fact and this fact and ask you to plug it into a formula that I give you. That's the boring word problem. Or I can say, Kathleen, what do you think matters to you when you're looking at a grocery line? What factors matter to you? Give me three, would you?
Well, one is how many items the person has, how many people are in line, and then how many items they have in their grocery cart. And I also actually look at the efficiency of the cashier. Some of them
nice.
Are very fast.
Nice. And let me ask you for two things. Give me two things that don't matter in the grocery store to help you figure out which line to get into. What things are you ignoring? Out of all the things you could pay attention to, what are you ignoring?
Oh, well, I am ignoring, I guess I ignore, if it's a very short line, I don't pay attention to the fact that as much as I should, how much stuff is in that one person's bag. I ignore, it's more what I do. I also pay attention to whether or not they brought their own bags, because it's
faster. Brought their own bags?
Yeah, that's all.
Serious shopper, someone who's not going to mess around.
Faster.
But you probably ignore things like the color of their clothing, just to be clear
sure.
what I'm angling
okay.
at here. Like, those are,
yeah,
there's lots that doesn't matter here.
Right.
What I'm trying to say is that now that we've had this conversation, if I were to offer you information about the grocery line, it'd be that much easier for you to handle that information and use it because we've had this debate. Imagine the alternative where I say I write in a word problem, you're in a grocery line, there's five people in front of you, they have a total of 150 items in their cart, evaluate those numbers in this formula, what's the answer? And now we have what was an interesting conversation between you and me has now become completely sterilized
right.
in the format of a textbook word problem, though they're exactly the same question.
Interesting. Oh, that's interesting. Let's go to more callers. Glenn in Blue Mound. Hi, Glenn.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi
there, guest. I've always enjoyed number games immensely. I'm one of those people that just always enjoyed it. Anyway, when I was on the road, I might say, well, if I speed up 5 miles an hour faster, how soon will I get there? If I slow down 5 miles, how long will it take? How much longer? Anyway, when we were talking about the national debt in those like 16 to 18 trillion numbers, and I can't wrap my head around that very much. So what I ended up doing, they talked about sending those rovers to Mars, 240 million miles away.
Right.
If you tape a $2 bill's end to end, that's a foot, because they're 6 inches long. To come up with $17 trillion is 4 round trips to Mars on dollar bills.
Whoa. Whoa.
Now, how's that for a number game?
Whoa, Glenn, that's a good one. Dan, what do you say?
I love it because here's two reasons why I love it. Number one is I've driven around Wisconsin doing workshops with teachers, and I know the feeling of having a long drive across Wisconsin, pretty country, pretty territory. It was spring, thankfully, but having your mind kind of wander to those kinds of number games.
Right,
so
right.
I'm transported back. Number two, I love that this is the superpower, if you will, of the math student. That, you know, like there's very superheroes that have superpowers, and one of our superpowers is the ability to contextualize enormous numbers, incomprehensible numbers, in ways that are comprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the caller has just done. And so whenever I get a charge, I hear this story from the caller, and I get a charge hearing his analysis, I ask myself, why do I not feel that same way in school mathematics, and what can we do about it?
Right. Thank you, Glenn, so much for your call. But, you know, I have to wonder, as I was listening to Glenn, that's probably the last thing in the world that would happen to me as I'm driving along Wisconsin. I'd be, you know, listening to a discussion on public radio, or I'd be toe-tapping to some music that's up really loud. My mind would never do numbers games. Is that a result of not having the right kind of math brain development as a kid? Or is it just that there are some people whose minds go that way?
You know, there's just, as I mentioned to the previous caller, there's been no math gene discovered. There's no, like, math person or math brain discovered. If there is one discovered, I'll be very surprised. What we have discovered, what we do know, is that people's adult life experiences with math are strongly predicted by whether or not they enjoyed math as a student. That if your students, through your 12 years of secondary school, taught you that math was something hostile, forbidding, and scary, or if that's the message that they that you got from your teachers, whether it was intentional or not, you're very unlikely to let your mind wander there in a peaceful moment on the road, because that would not be a peaceful thing to think about for you. And that's, you know, that's sad, but I'm happy that we're being cordial, you and me, together in spite of all that.
Yeah, right. I'm also wondering about how sequential math appears to be, Dan. Is that true that it's taught in such a way that if you miss a little bit of algebra in ninth grade or whatever, and you get thrown into, or maybe geometry was first, and then you get into algebra, that you don't have the basis, so that if you're struggling with some aspect of math, before you know it, there you are at the next level, and you're not the, you don't have all that you need to know. Is it sequential instruction, and it has to be taught that way?
I mean, certainly more so than a lot of other subjects where things loop back and you can kind of remediate faster in other subjects, I think, than in math class. But, like, this reminds me, my mom does not feel similarly about math as you, I think. And she tells me the story of growing up in Anoka, Minnesota. And her family transferred to a different place, a different city, not far away. And she was like, the schedules were misaligned by 1 month.
Mm.
And that one
mm-hmm.
month was enough for her to feel totally
yep.
lost,
yep.
a feeling that chased her throughout the rest of her math. So I think that you bring up a really important challenge there, one which I think I'm grateful that we're considering and in many cases have adopted national standards across states, which just means that, like, if I'm a student and I move from one state to another because my mom or dad has a new job, I'm less likely to get in that situation where, oh my goodness, seventh grade math here means something totally different than in California. And in these standards we're considering that we have, there's also a focus on big ideas, not like the minutia of the year, but across multiple grades. What does it mean to multiply two numbers together from first to fifth grade? Or how do numbers turn into variables across three grades? I'm glad that we're focusing on big ideas to hopefully minimize those experiences that my mom had and that you're hypothesizing
right.
about here.
Yeah, it's interesting. The very same thing happened to me. It was fifth grade, and we moved, and they were way ahead of me, and that was it. It was fifth grade. I'm interested in the kinds of – have you already developed this math textbook of the future?
No, it's in development. It's in research and development. I'm so grateful for teachers that allow me into their classrooms to test ideas out. I'm part of a vibrant community on the internet. The math Twitter blogosphere tests out all these ideas and peppers me and us with feedback. This is the Wild West, the idea, the question of how does technology and math class interact? And so we're currently working on those ideas at Desmos.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls. We'll take more of them. The man who is called the most famous math teacher in America, Dan Meyer, is with us. Dan taught high school math for a number of years. He is currently working on a whole new wave of math textbooks. He is the chief academic officer at Desmos, where he explores and develops the future of math textbooks and his problems that he has solved or had many students think about have found their way to TV shows all over the country because it's everyday problems and using an exciting way of thinking of math to come up with answers to things that would be good for us to have answers for. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to Jane in Minocqua next. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Joy. I just had an experience in school very different from yours. I am 77, so I was going through elementary school basically in the 40s, and my father was a welder on the big oil pipelines that were built across the United States, and we moved with him, and I very often went to three or four schools a year. I can remember moving into schools where I was way ahead. I moved into schools where I was way behind, and I moved into one school where they were doing long division, and they had no clue what they were doing. But I didn't want to tell anybody that I didn't know, and I just watched them work problems on the board until I figured it out on my own.
Mm.
I consider that to be the most valuable educational experience I ever had in my whole life. I have a master's degree in biochemistry,
oh my goodness.
And I think that learning that analysis was the reason I went the way of math and science.
Hmm. Can you learn on your own, Dan?
That's just an awesome story.
It is amazing.
The number one of eight on these Common Core state practices is persevering, and it's a discipline that I'm sure we'd all agree on the phone here is important, not just in math class but in life.
Right.
There's this cusp though that I worry about where our caller stayed on the right side of that cusp and persevered and pushed through, and it's almost like a fuse though. A cusp is probably the wrong metaphor. There's a fuse that I've seen trip in students so often, and it's almost a visible fuse tripping where you see the light extinguish from behind their eyes, and they don't say what our caller said, which is like, I'm going to get this and learn this. It's that math is impossible for me to learn. And so, like, while I agree that perseverance is so important and we need to inculcate that in students, just tossing students in the deep end is not going to be a replicable strategy that will keep students on the right side of that cusp with the fuse tripped in the right direction, I don't think. But I'd be open to our caller's ideas and anybody's ideas of how to create perseverance in our students.
Mm-hmm. Jane, how do you create perseverance? You have an answer?
Well, you know what? I'm a former chemistry teacher.
Oh.
And I did it. And I saw the lights come on all over my classroom. I kept telling them, this is easy. You just need to think through it. This is easy. The problem is telling people it's hard, and that's when they turn off.
Mm.
Yeah, encouragement is what worked for you. Is that what I'm understanding?
You know what else worked for me, too, is the students were far more important than the subject matter. I think that's the key to all learning.
That's a fun comment. I mean, the students, I'm sure, they feel that. They feel that kind of respect for them and their ideas. I think it'd be important right now, like the requisite mention in some circles of having a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset on intelligence, this idea that with work you can become smarter. You can there is not a fixed, like, math people aren't a thing. They aren't a species, this rare species of math and science people who just get it, and you weren't born that way. I'm sorry. That hard work counts for so much here. And so when you say telling students that math is, or that the subject is hard would have been a problem for them, I say yes, and also telling them that hard work is a necessary feature of your education is going to be important too.
Thanks, Jane, so much for your call and your encouragement. Maria in Madison, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a piano teacher, and so I'm constantly doing math, fractions, which is really hard to get across to young students. But I guess my question has always been, why are we not using practical applications? Like when I was learning to sew a tablecloth, I had to pull out my geometry textbook and, you know, use my triangle formulas. And whenever I'm installing shelving or anything in my household, I've got to do my measuring tape and figure out if I've got the right size. So there's so many hands-on applications for math, and I'm just surprised the school system doesn't use more of them.
Mm. It's interesting you mentioned that. I agree, but I want to just toss some extra light on that comment. I think is that math does not lack for great commercials of math's power. We have posters that you can buy online that show you where different parts of math are useful in music, in home, you know, home economics and construction and wherever else. You can buy these posters. You can show these videos. There's websites and grants funded for showing interviews with people who use math in their day-to-day work. We don't lack for these commercials. What we lack is experiences where students experience the power of mathematics rather than just hearing people talk about it. So what I'm saying is you've used math in powerful ways in music in the home. And there's a curious mutation that happens when we take those experiences that you've had and put them in a textbook where they become what Kathleen and I have been talking about, where what was exhilarating becomes rather boring and disempowering, where you read this word problem in a paragraph that talks about, well, so-and-so is trying to create a level shelf, and the angle is this, and its dimensions are these, and so on and so on. You know, what is the best way to place it? And it's a difference of presentations, a difference in not putting the student in your shoes as you were in your home doing that. And that's what multimedia, I think, allows me to do is to take a picture of this shelving that you're installing and asking students, like, what should I do here? And having a moment of interaction that's uncommon in textbooks where we're debating the process. So, yes, we are using applications. We are using applications. There are sections in the textbook that say application, but the problem is the format and presentation of those does not testify to what you found helpful and exhilarating about math.
Thank you, Maria, so much for your call. Catherine in Madison, hi.
Hi. I have a math story from high school that actually encompasses both things. I went to school in Manhattan at a vocational school in like 1963, 64, and my algebra class, my first algebra class, had Mr. Blessing, who was a really colorful character, and he used stories about going to the racetrack. If you won $80 and you lost 90, what were you up or down? And I got like 76 without doing the work, and he told my dad if I studied, I'd get in the 90s. Well, they, for some reason, took us all out of that class, put us in with a guy who had taught college math, and we all got 20, literally. So then I had to go through three times to take algebra over again, and then they stuck me in geometry 6 weeks late because I had been taking the algebra. Mm-hmm. And so I kept my honors classes for my academics, and we had academics and vocational, and they tracked everyone, and then there were the vocational students. So I had science with them, and one day our teacher wasn't there in this basic science course, and we had the substitute teacher, and she had us play this game, and we were using numbers. And this is the kids that know that they're supposed to be dumber. And when she was done, she said, by the way, you all did calculus.
Gosh, there's so much there, isn't there?
Yes.
Number one, the difference that a teacher makes.
Right.
How this first teacher is exceptional and empowers students, and the next is disempowering. And the thought that we can somehow encode the empowering one into a computer program just beggars my belief. It's just so sophisticated what that exceptional teacher was doing there. And same with that third teacher, accessing students' informal understanding of calculus, whereas other teachers might say, like, there is no way to appreciate calculus aside from the formal level of definitions and procedures and formulas. It's like, no, the core ideas of calculus, of rate of change, of accumulation are comprehensible to young kids even. That takes a certain kind of math knowledge, student knowledge, teaching knowledge. It's incredible.
Yeah. What a wonderful story. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bill in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Okay.
Good.
I have a question. I work with a lot of students or kids that just graduated. And in our job, they have a hard time adding or multiplying in their head. They say they're so used to using the calculator that they can't do it in their head. And so I was just curious of the comment on that.
Yeah, excellent question. It's you pose what is just an enormous fissure in math education. There's enormous debates around this very question of calculator use among elementary students. And so I don't claim to have a perfect answer here or one I'm settled on, but I will say this. What I know is that we no longer teach students to do things that calculators can currently do. This has happened in the past. It will happen again. For instance, looking up the answers to square root computations in a table in the back of your textbook, or the same for logarithms or sine, trigonometric functions. We had all these things that we had to carry around books to help us look up. And eventually calculators made that irrelevant, and we no longer do that. Is the same true about multiplication and division of these numbers? I don't think so, not entirely, but I do think it does change the emphasis, again, of what we need to ask students to do. Perhaps less of that computation, these endless worksheets full of drills, and more estimation, the stuff that calculators can't handle. For instance, 23 times 18, is that more or less than 400? That kind of question has more value to me, whatever me is here, teacher, employer, whatever, than can you do this by hand on a piece of paper?
Hmm.
Yeah. I know a lot of times they write on the table. We got ceramic or tables you can wipe off, and so they're doing it all on the table, and I'm sitting there, well, I'm doing it in my head, so.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Donna in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I just was calling as a parent of a high school student and a middle school student. who has been working with them on math. And there are a couple comments I would make about online textbooks. One is that they need to have enough examples that the parents can refresh their memory on how to do the problem themselves. And two is that since the kid no longer comes home with a book and is doing chapter X, oftentimes you don't know where they are. So, and it's very hard to use an index in an online book and try to figure out, well, what is the name of this function that they're struggling with and how would I find that in this program? And those are just two things that I would say. And then the third is just the whole question of online textbooks. I've never seen a kid sit down and flip through the pages of an online textbook, but I have seen my kids sit down and flip through their biology text or their social studies text and look at the pictures. And I wonder, I think that the online books they're currently using are fairly clunky and slow-moving, so it's not a particularly pleasurable experience for them. So those are just thoughts for future development of textbooks.
Thank you. Dan?
This is great market research here on WPR.
Absolutely.
My Desmos company here. Number one, I would say I'm the parent of very small children, and the thought of being a parent in this day and age of a high school or a junior higher with the, like, how different and how fast-changing education is sounds very challenging, and so I respect your work immensely in trying to navigate all this. In terms of, like, math has been changing since parents of high school students were students themselves, and so that's its own challenge also. The general clunkiness of online math education currently, the sense that we're trying to learn to speak computer math at the same time as we're struggling to learn to speak math itself is something that I feel keenly. And so, like, you're trying to navigate horrible user interface and trying to format your math in a way the computer will understand. I've heard so many stories like our callers, and I wish that every ed tech company had heard that and understands that as easy as their products are for, like, tech nerds out here in the Silicon Valley, we have a long way to go to make this stuff accessible and interesting to students and their parents even.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John. Mike in Racine. Hi.
Hi. An earlier caller covered a little bit. I guess I want to expand on the teaching using technology. As someone who's took their math in the 70s, got a chemistry degree, worked as a professional chemist with a lot of computerized equipment, and have to use math or had to use math every day in their job, advanced math in many cases. I over the years, as we had young people come in, those that got further and further away from my generation who learned how to do things on paper, learned how to do things like use the log of 2 and log of 3 and log of 1 and log of 0, and you can take a log of any number. You know, things like that where you learned how to get a feel for the numbers. I saw and continue to see as we get more and more young people in that they are not able to think on their feet when trying to work a challenging problem that involves either advanced math or just math in general. And I guess I take a little bit of an issue with the idea that we shouldn't be doing calculations. I think they shouldn't be touching a calculator or a computer until they have demonstrated that they understand the advanced concepts.
Mm-hmm. We have less than a minute. Dan?
I buy it. It's a nice way to phrase the difference, that students need to basically earn the automated tools by understanding how they work. If the calculator is a black box, you put numbers in and numbers come out, that'd be a disservice to all of us, basically. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, you did that in a lot less than a minute. You must have had some mathematical reasoning going on when you looked
at how
much time was left, right? Yeah. Dan, thank you very much for being with us. And is there anything that we should reference? We've got the TED Talk, and you also have a blog, don't you?
Yeah, if you just Google Dan Meyer, Twitter, blog, whatever, I'm findable. Get in touch with me. My email address is out there.
Okay.
To keep the conversation going with your listeners.
Okay. Thanks, Dan, so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Dan Meyer, he's taught high school math to students who weren't crazy about math. He has now been working on developing the future of math textbooks. He is the chief academic officer at Desmos. And he came to national prominence because of an experiment that he did about grocery lines, which found its way on Good Morning America, I believe it was. So he looks at math in a totally different way than most of us did when we were growing up learning math. Dan Meyer, and you can find him, he just Google his name. You'll find interesting things. It's M-E-Y-E-R. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, to K.P. Whaley for all on-air production work here in our studios. We're with you again tomorrow. Real interesting shows starting at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Thanks for listening.